is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker, welcome one and all to the Grahamian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Glad as always to be here with you. Keeping you company through space and time for another week as we examine unusual things happening in our sphere of existence. That's right. Dial it up to 11. Let's get ready to go. Lots to cover tonight. In fact, a few things I've been looking at, in addition to the ancient history and mystery associated with plants, but also one of the most famous archaeological discoveries of all time and how one may have been stolen recently, we have a huge update as it relates to a very unexplainable occurrence that happened last November. I don't know that it's very unexplainable, but it remains unexplained, and it involves an unidentified object seen over Oregon. Yeah, we've got a rather significant update on that. And then later in the program, many who have listened for years to this show knows that Micah Hanks, yours truly, I have maintained a fascination with the underworld, with caves. One of the reasons that we joke about the Hollow Earth so much on this program, in fact. And so we're going to indulge that underworldly interest in hour two and take a look at some of the oddities associated with the world below us. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there is an incredible amount of biodiversity that still exists underground, which has yet to be discovered. If we want to talk about cryptozoology, the idea of undiscovered animals, really we should just be spending more time underground. But really, what else could be down there? We'll look at all of that and more a little later in the program. And as the most observant among you in the listening audience may already be aware, I am flying solo this week. Matt Oakley recovering from this flu that's been going around. That's right. Race Hobbo Hobbs, on the other hand, he's not sick. He's just on his way back from the International UFO Congress. So glad to be here hanging out with you guys for another week of indulging our mutual interest in the unusual. That's right. So while I didn't make it to the UFO Congress, of course, I was hearing from everybody who was out there over the weekend. Gigi, my good pal, Cortana, those, of course, the two hosts of the podcast Shift Happens. In fact, I went on that program with Gigi the other night. And of course, I also heard Alejandro Rojas did a fantastic job, but we would expect no less from him. So indeed, glad to hear it was a great time for everybody. I, on the other hand, remained behind despite numerous invitations to attend various workshops and different events that were going on over the weekend. It was a busy weekend potentially, but that's right. I stayed here in pocket at Grahamian Studios because, well, among other things, it's tax season. And I'm trying to get a bunch of that stuff together. There's a reason, folks. While they refer to economics as the dismal science, we'll go ahead and put that behind business and finance too. I'll have none of it if I can help it. But unfortunately, it is part of the reality of adulting in America today. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, so we'll just go ahead and leave that behind. One thing that someone probably should have left behind, but he apparently didn't, and now it's got him in hot water with Chinese authorities. There's a man who allegedly stole a thumb from a priceless archaeological artifact, that of course being one of the terracotta warrior statues that's on display in the U.S. right now. A man reportedly removed one of the thumbs on one of these statues, and Chinese authorities are now demanding severe punishment for this man. This according to China's state-owned Xinhua news agency. Now, the statue in question dates back to around 209 B.C. Its estimated worth is probably, it's valued at around $4.5 million. And it is one of the 10 Chinese terracotta warriors on loan to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, where they've recently been on display. The thumb came from the life-size clay soldier known as the Cavalryman. So some of you who have been to this exhibit may have even seen this Cavalryman. If you noticed a thumb was missing, that is a recent departure from the exhibit. Now, the director of the Shaanxi Cultural Heritage Promotion Center, which loaned the statues, lashed out at the museum on Monday, saying it was careless in guarding the warrior, which has apparently lost a thumb. We ask that the U.S. severely punish the perpetrator. We have lodged a serious protest with them, according to Wu Haiyun, as reported by the BBC. USA Today reports on this also that the soldier was part of a terracotta army that provided afterlife security at the burial complex of China's first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, The statues are on display at the museum until March 4th, although it's questionable how much longer they will remain there if Chinese authorities continue to dispute the guarding which left, or I guess, or lack thereof, which allowed for one of the thumbs on one of these statues to go missing. Now, presently, there are federal authorities looking into this, and they're saying that Michael Roana, a 24-year-old man from Delaware, stole the thumb. He was charged with the theft and also concealment of a major artwork and later released on a $15,000 bail. They said that the guest at a party at the Philadelphia Museum in December slipped into a closed exhibit and snipped off part of a sculpture while he was there. What a genius! Can we give this guy the Genius Award? Taking priceless archaeological treasures and defacing them so that he can have a thumb to put in his private collection. I mean, I wonder if he's gone around and done this at other places too. You know, here in the United States, it is actually a federal offense in many instances to remove archaeological items. You've got to be very careful about things like that. And even things which may not appear to be archaeologically significant can still qualify. And people will often pick up things that they aren't aware may be an item of archaeological significance. You know, for example, the Seven Ages team and I last fall, we went to a location called Flint Ridge in Ohio. And it's just a really nice little trail that kind of meanders through these large heaps and these pits. And what they represent, of course, are thousands of years of Native American occupation where they would go and they would mine very precious resources from this area, specifically chert or flint. And it's a particularly beautiful kind of banded, almost rainbow-colored flint that can be recovered from this area, and hence the name Flint Ridge. There's been a lot written about it, but for thousands of years, this site was of significance because they would mine the flint from the area, and the Native Americans would use this to produce stone tools. You can still find large quantities of flint there, in fact, and more importantly, all over the site, even on the main trails at the park that resides there today, you can find flint that was chipped by ancient hands thousands of years ago. But here's the thing. Those flint chippings aren't tools per se themselves, but they were nonetheless removed by ancient human hands. And so there's a sign right outside of the Flint Ridge area that says you're not to remove anything of archaeological significance from this site. But in the case of the 24-year-old thief from Delaware who removed a thumb from one of the terracotta soldiers, it was pretty difficult, I suppose, for him to determine what this was and whether it was archaeologically significant, right? This must have been a mistake. Quite the contrary, it was obviously intended that he take something priceless, and now Chinese authorities want, well, probably more than just severe punishment. I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But on the subject of ancient mysteries, over the last few months, really all throughout 2017, it was an ongoing thing that we were pushing back human discoveries as it relates to human origins and things along those lines, but shifting over into the area of flora rather than fauna. We're also pushing back the origins on land plants. And this reported by BBC News, they're saying that land plants evolved from pond scum about 500 million years ago. And new research says that a seminal event in Earth's history, which is the plants moving from mere pond scum onto land and thriving there, may actually have happened 100 million years earlier than previously thought. And this would have constituted essentially what were moss-like plants that began to cover entire continents, greening and eventually fomenting growth of what we know today as various shrubbery and grasses, trees. It all began in very similar fashion, in fact, to that of land-based animals as we know them today. Primordial pools which contained amino acids and other building blocks of life which slowly over time came together, forming simple organisms, and then later becoming multicellular organisms that exist in aquatic environments, and then moving on to land slowly thereafter. I mean, this process taking millions and millions of years. But essentially, plants did the same thing, and much like life as we know it today in terms of biological organisms that are present on our planet, plants did essentially the same thing. I mean, they're no less biological organisms, but we make that distinction between the flora and the fauna. And so this occurred with plants much earlier than we thought, too. Now, according to a new study on this, Dr. Philip Donahue of the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol in England, one of the study's authors, says that land plants emerged on land half a billion years ago, tens of millions of years older than the fossil record alone suggests. And even though you can find fossil representations of these early plant species, one might assume that it would be a little more difficult to account for algae and things like that in the fossil record. Not impossible, but definitely a little more difficult to spot, we'll say. According to Donahue, he says this changes perception of the nature of early terrestrial environments, displacing pond scum in favor of a flora that would have tickled your toes but not reached much higher. Our results, of course, he said, show that the ancestor of land plants were alive in the Middle Cambrian period, which was similar to the age for the first known terrestrial animals. Quite fascinating stuff. There's so much to the ancient world that we don't know. And that reminds me, in fact, I was talking with a fellow at one of the events that KGRA did back last fall in Utah, and he had studied geology there under Professor Adolf Jonk at the University of Utah, who is an expert on various periods in the ancient world. Part of what drew him to that area, in fact, I was told that he could have easily gotten tenure at a larger Ivy League university, but he said, I wanted to go and teach at a university that was there in the heart of what geologically I was most fascinated by. And in that area of the high desert, I mean, there's just so much to learn if you're a geologist. But one of his primary areas of interest is what is known as the snowball Earth. And the snowball Earth hypothesis holds that at some point in the very distant past, Earth went through at least one period where most, if not all, of the planet was completely glaciated, covered in ice, a literal snowball floating out there in space. And that, in fact, there may have been other instances where the Earth was a giant snowball like this. We know at least of one. And while we can't prove that there are others, I mean, there's geological evidence that definitely supports periods of extreme glaciation far greater than the ice age that we came out of most recently, around 12,800, 12,900 years ago. I'm always fascinated by things like that. We turn back the clock on our planet and we look at the periods of different stages of evolution that have occurred on this planet with biology. We look at, I mean, again, the simple fact that this Earth was once ruled by giant lizards, that dinosaurs roamed this Earth millions of years ago, that alone to me is fascinating. That our entire Earth was populated by massive creatures, incredibly large, extinct, of course, by today's standards, extinct reptiles that are much more like the kinds of things you would expect to see in a fantasy fiction novel, and that this was the reality of life on our planet. That's one reason that for me, it's not so difficult to imagine there being mystery species. If we want to talk about cryptozoology, and we've done a lot of that over the last few weeks, so we're going to try and kind of move away from that this week and get into other things. But it's one reason why I think that idea remains almost preeminent on the minds of those who study the unexplained. I think that when it comes to mystery animals, new discoveries in the field of biology, that is one of the most likely areas where an unexplained phenomena might come to pass and be discovered and accounted for and recognized as being a reality by science. And when we look at the diversity of different life that has come and gone on this planet in the ancient past, it doesn't seem impossible to me that there are maybe a number of different unique species, perhaps at least some of them representative of large undiscovered species that could be found. And once we learn about them, what does this tell us about our own evolution and the likelihood of other things similarly existing on planet Earth? I mean, again, the point to all this would be that if a creature like Sasquatch, mythological, folkloric, though it may actually be, but if it were proven to exist, it would not just say, hey, and now we know this creature exists. It would, I think, cause a bit of a paradigm shift, if you want to use that occasionally sensationalized terminology. It would, at very least, change our perception of what can exist out there. I think that if that creature especially were ever proven to exist, that would make such a fundamental statement in the sciences. It would, for those who have all said it couldn't have existed, it would really make us go, wow, okay, we were saying with certainty it couldn't exist, then it was found that it did exist. This changes our entire perspective on what else could be out there. And I think that really a kind of an open-mindedness might follow suit. And perhaps that has happened in the past, too, with the discovery of creatures like mountain gorillas, once also relegated to folklore. That is an argument often made by cryptozoologists. The big difference, of course, here being that if you discover a species like that in a fairly remote part of the world versus one that exists in a part of the world and on a continent that is largely populated in modern times, there's definitely a big difference there in terms of the potential for the discovery of something like that in North America as opposed to discovering a species like mountain gorillas in Africa. Okay, and we all have to recognize that. But nonetheless, I do think that something akin to a paradigm shift might occur if a significantly large undiscovered species, and one that had been recognized in the so-called cryptozoological literature, were discovered. That could indeed be a game changer in terms not only of the discovery of a new species, but thought as it is applied to the likelihood of similar things existing elsewhere in the world. Now, before we go to a break, I got to switch gears here. Moving from the scientifically plausible, if not unlikely, to the downright weird, in Australia there is a machine, and this was recently reported on a news link sent to me by Janet Fitzgerald, one of our newsies over in Ireland, and this machine reportedly allows anyone who has the access key to end their life by simply pressing a button. Now you may be asking, why would you want to do something like this? But according to Australia's best-known euthanasia activist, Dr. Philip Nitschke, apparently this machine is designed for aiding those who wish to in committing suicide. Of course, an ever-controversial subject. Developed in the Netherlands by Nitschke and an engineer friend, the machine, they say, can be 3D printed and assembled in any location. And therefore access to the Sarco capsule, as it's being called, will be by an online mental questionnaire which will provide a 4-digit access code to the individual who decides to undertake the process. When the person, they say, lies in the capsule, this according to LifeNews.com, he can activate it and liquid nitrogen will rapidly drop the oxygen level, leading to death in just a few minutes. The novel feature, if you want to call it that, is that the capsule can be detached from the Sarco machine and used as a sleek and shiny coffin. And then the machine base can be reused. Of all inventions, you know, we knew years ago that 3D printing was going to lead to some real innovations. Like, for instance, if we take a 3D printer and various materials into space, we can essentially create anything that we want in space with 3D printing. Maybe not anything, but I mean, a lot of different practical tools can be made on the spot with little more than an operating system and a desire to make them. But you think about 3D printers being used to assist in suicides. I don't know. To me, again, I understand there are multiple levels that must be considered in terms of mental health, psychology, and all of these kind of things. And it's been a contentious issue, not just in Australia, but of course here in the United States. You remember Dr. Kevorkian a number of years ago. He'd been a proponent of this very sort of thing, medically assisted suicide for people who are perhaps terminally ill. A lot of questions remain. But again, using a 3D printed device, which not only assists in a suicide, but then makes for a sleek, shiny, and futuristic looking coffin, something about that just seems not only morbidly fascinating, but also a little, I don't know, retro-productive. Is that even a term? Futuristic though it may appear nonetheless, it's weird however I think you look at it. Well, when we return after this, I want to talk about the new updates with regard to this Oregon UFO incident. There's some new audio that's been revealed too. We'll tackle that when we return on the Graylian Report. Mountains of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. As always, keeping you company from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, Monday nights via KGRARadio.com, our home, and happily here on the web. Glad as always to be here with you. So, a question. Have we been seeing the tides change as it relates to official government positions and reactions, especially in terms of general secrecy, toward the subject of unidentified flying objects? I don't think that's a crazy question by any means, and if anything that we've seen in the last few months is an indicator, then indeed maybe we're making some progress, and that alone is exciting. But even apart from the discussion about the Pentagon program, Luis Elizondo and others coming out in relation to the To the Stars Academy for Arts and Sciences, talking about this, releasing some new footage, kind of getting the debate going, at least among some. There are many in the scientific community who still dispute that there's anything worth seeing here. But back in November of last year, before all of that made headlines, courtesy of the New York Times, there was an incident which we reported on this program, and you may remember, that involved an unidentified aircraft. Now, it wasn't described as being tic-tac-shaped or necessarily carrying out maneuverability that was very esoteric, if not improbable, in terms of what we understand about physics, like what the Pentagon says that they've been studying for a number of years. What we saw instead over Oregon was just apparently a conventional aircraft, but one which was not following standard protocols in terms of communication, and it was, we will say, behaving anomalously. And there were, in fact, jet aircraft scrambled, F-15 fighters, launched to try and pursue this aircraft and find out why exactly it wasn't following standard aviation protocols, according to FAA standards. Now, Tyler Rogoway had reported about this at The Drive last November, and there's been an update and some audio released, which may be rather telling. And so he has an update for us, and he reports that through the Freedom of Information Act, he says, we present what could be one of the most insightful instances of official documentation surrounding such an encounter that had already been confirmed to have occurred by both the FAA and the U.S. Air Force. He says, these materials include fascinating audio recordings of radio transmissions and phone calls made as the incident was unfolding, as well as pilot interviews and conversations between FAA officials made in the aftermath of the highly peculiar incident. Now, he goes on to say, for proper context, make sure to first read the original post. We reported on that, of course, on the program, so you'll probably remember, and if not, if you go back in our archives, the episode in question at graylianreport.com is titled Oregon's Mystery Aircraft or something along those lines, and you can go back and listen to the reporting that we did on that. And Rogoway reports that this is representative of rare confirmations as to the authenticity of such a report, both from the FAA and the U.S. Air Force. So where do things stand now as far as an update? Now, here is what Tyler reports in the update. He says that what we know is that the target was moving, quote, very fast at 37,000 feet when it was first detected. They said that this, what was referred to in the audio, and we'll hear a little of that here in a moment, but the intruder it was referred to quickly dropped off radar, and that's when the visual sightings made by airline crews began. They continued for roughly half an hour over hundreds of miles. Tyler also reports that the exchanges that were shared during this period between the nearby aircraft pilots and air traffic control in the region regarding the unidentified aircraft were constant during the audio that was released to The Drive, with the same description coming back time and time again. They said it was a white aircraft cruising around 37,000 feet, too far away to tell the type or if it had markings of any kind on it. Now, keep in mind, they release a video there with this, and we'll have this linked in the show notes, but apparently air traffic controllers are noting, while talking to FAA authorities, that F-15s out of PDX are about to be scrambled. The controller also states that there had been little or no radar contact with the aircraft. The controller in the recording also repeatedly asks air crews nearby to check their traffic collision avoidance systems for the aircraft, all of them coming back negative. This is really interesting. The F-15s appear on the radar. They climb out of Portland to the south. Now, what they do is they apparently they contact a number of the aircraft in the region. Alaska 439 is heard on radar, one of the aircraft, asking for an update on the unidentified aircraft, and the controller notes that they still have nothing on him, saying that it must be a kind of stealth mode or something, that the aircraft is operating in a variety of stealth mode. What in the world? Could it have been a drone? They say it's also interesting that the F-15s were first sent south, and then it seems as if the object would have been north of the airbase that they were scrambled from by the time that they finally launched out of Portland. Now, here's what's interesting is Tyler Rogoway reports that there are a number of interesting recordings of FAA phone calls that occurred that were part of what was released to them in response to this. While all this is going on, FAA authorities are going back and forth with each other trying to figure out what's going on. He notes that it's unclear whether the FAA may have redacted certain parts of the conversations, but he notes, and I'll quote him here, he says, there were a few strange areas where conversations went mute, and it's not clear if this was edited or just an anomaly. He says the primary person talking in most of these calls is the operations manager in charge for Seattle Center at the time the incident took place. The first call was made to Oakland Center, and it occurs early on after the initial radar detection as pilots began spotting this craft visually, and he also mentions at that time that, quote, air defense, unquote, is looking for the target on radar, so it shows how early the military was involved in the encounter. And there's a term that keeps coming up, too, DEN or DEN. It's referred to repeatedly in the recordings. That apparently is the Domestic Events Network, a sort of hotline system that is used to bridge the FAA with federal authorities. And here we have another, although a humorous one, a turn for the anomalous. Okay, the term WADS comes in. Okay, this being a reference to the Western Air Defense Sector of NORAD, but they have an unusual nickname for this. That's right, Bigfoot. The nickname or call sign used for the WADS system is Bigfoot, and you'll hear them referring to this. So they're not actually seeing a Sasquatch, but they are referring to the Western Air Defense Sector of NORAD. It's really interesting, though. I mean, so much of this stuff going on, and part of the reason, of course, that that is the name given to that is because in that region where NORAD is operative, yes, this is the same region generally associated with belief in the existence of the Sasquatch. So they nicknamed that portion, the WADS system, Bigfoot. Now, with the documents and audio that were released to the drive, there are a number of interviews also, and arguably what Tyler Rogoway calls one of the most interesting involves the pilot of a Southwest 4712 aircraft. He apparently says he notes in the call how strange the encounter was, how he's never seen an incident like it in nearly 30 years of flying jets, and says, quote, if it was like a Lear or private jet type airframe, I probably would not have seen it this clear. He says this was a white airplane and it was big. And it was moving at a clip, too, because we were keeping pace with it. It probably was moving faster than we were. It was a larger aircraft. Yeah. He also said that they watched the object from Northern California all the way to their descent into Portland. Now, if it indeed were as large as he says it was, a large white aircraft that they couldn't identify, does that still leave the possibility of a drone on the table? I don't know, maybe that's not as likely as it may have seemed at one point. It doesn't sound an awful lot like a drone to me. It sounds very much like a large white manned aircraft that nobody was able to make out at the distance it was seen, but that the thing was at 37,000 feet, moving quickly, not responding to communications, and certainly not being picked up on crash avoidance systems by aircraft in the area. So what was it? We'll now move on to some of the audio that was released in response to the FOIA request following the incident.
Someone was trying to speak to QC via the rock earlier today.
Oh, I don't know. Well, maybe. I mean, so I called just to give the rock a little information about an unusual event that happened this evening. And I'm working on filling out the MOR. Oakland gave us a call about a MOTC intruder that they had in their airspace, that they were observing in their airspace right at our boundary. And then later called back and said, well, now it's going northbound at 37,000 and we had a Southwest flight that was observing it. So we tracked that airplane. Well, we didn't have him on radar. We weren't talking to him, but just through pilot reports, we were tracking this aircraft. We were in the communication with the DEN and then WADS, and then they end up scrambling fighters. But the aircraft that were observing the target at 37,000 started their descent for Portland prior to the fighters getting there, so we kind of lost sight of it. But anyway, so I'm just doing the initial paperwork for this, and I was in communication with the DEN earlier. I've spoken to the three flight crews of the three aircraft that did observe this traffic to write us up a little kind of summary of what exactly they saw. And they're going to send that to the DEN. And so anyway, we're just kind of going through this paperwork process now.
So you said the aircraft had started a descent toward Portland. Do we know at this point who he is or what's going on?
No, I don't know if that traffic was descending for Portland. I'm saying that the aircraft that we were in communication with that had been observing the target had to descend for Portland. So where this guy ended up, we don't know.
Oh, so we still don't know.
No. The fighter scrambled. They went out looking around a little bit, but we lost anybody having sight of the aircraft.
Wow, that's weird.
It's really weird, yeah. So, anyway, all three of these flight crews are going to write up a little summary or synopsis of what they saw and any specifics, and they're going to email it to the den, and we'll go from there, I guess. So, anyway.
Did you guys get any information to indicate if it was a large carrier jet or something smaller?
So, the pilot that just called me back now from one that was observing it for probably 100 miles said it was a big jet. It was not some little small, he said it wasn't like a little Learjet or something like that. It was a pretty big jet. And it was going faster than they were. And this Southwest was, you know, it was a Southwest 737 in the flight levels. And, you know, they're going 450 knots across the ground. And this thing was going faster than them. So, so we don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And really kind of weird. So I don't know. I don't know if it's a SIG event or not, but I was going to initially do it as now. But it kind of started in Oakland's airspace, so I think Oakland's going to have an MOR on it as well.
Yeah,
as us.
I haven't checked Cedar yet, but I was just told by the op center that Oakland did enter an MOR, and they checked theirs off as potentially significant. So, I mean, you know, it's strange enough that if you check it off potentially significant, you could. I don't know that what else we can do at this point. Sounds like you did all the proper notifications going to the den and alerting the other officers that need to know.
Okay. So do you want me to check it as SIG or no?
Yeah, just go ahead and enter it as potentially significant, but I'm not anticipating anything coming forth as far as attention to, you know, or anything additional needed from the facility. Just document what you told me and the fact that you coordinate with the Dan Watts, Spider Scramble, and what we have.
Okay. So the other thing that may come up, just for your awareness, too, is that the Dan wasn't real happy because I get the impression they think that I ordered the scramble because they're the ones that are supposed to do that, and they did not. So they seemed a little upset by that. And I said I didn't order anything. I was just relaying information that they requested. So, So I don't know if that comes back in some type of a fashion as far as who ordered what.
You know, and if it does, I probably would not hear about it because that's, I don't know how they would communicate that back if they were not happy with it, because I don't know what channels they would normally use.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, this is a weird enough thing that there's not a set procedure. I think you guys did the right thing in doing all the notifications the way you did. Like I said, just document what you have, and Oakland Center's got one in there marked potentially significant also. I'm trying to get into Cedar, but it's pretty slow right this
moment. So I was going to do this as aircraft operated at an altitude speed. It's like a TCAS one, you know, like that particular drop down. I don't know if it's more appropriate to do something else. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
You know what? That sounds like an acceptable category.
Okay. Okay.
It's not often we hear about an unknown guy up at that altitude.
Right.
I guess it's not. An unknown guy up at that altitude. Something the size of a large jet moving quickly at 37,000 feet, not responding to communications, and a group of F-15s scrambled, and apparently the guy on the telephone, who they were pointing the finger at for having scrambled the thing, said, "I didn't issue that response," and that they didn't know who did. Now, it could be a bit, as we are seeing here, that there are governmental... Well, you could liken this to the old idea of the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. there obviously was some confusion because this was an inordinary kind of an event. It's not every day that an aircraft, and a large one, not presumably a drone, as it had been suggested earlier, this aircraft might have been. No, apparently a large aircraft appears, and it's not behaving typically. It's not following FAA designations. It is, if anything, operating illegally in the airspace. And again, by virtue of the speed and the lack of communication, there seems to be a certain evasiveness. I mean, what in the world is going on here? I guess for a lot of people, this wouldn't seem all that strange just because it doesn't seem to involve something extremely out of the ordinary, i.e. a flying saucer or something like that. But with all the standards and protocols between FAA, between U.S. Air Force, between NORAD, all the different agencies that were overseeing and monitoring as this situation unfolded, that this is still unexplainable is extremely weird. If not as weird as any UFO report that you're used to hearing about. I mean, I find this extraordinary, and I think that Tyler Rogoway at The Drive felt the same way. And he kind of summarizes the entire thing. He notes, collectively, these materials give us incredible insight not only into this incident, but also into how such an event is actually handled in real time by those who are responsible for the safety of those in the air and those on ground below. What they don't offer is any sort of explanation for what happened on that fall evening. But really, the fact that all those involved, from air traffic controllers to Air Force radar operators to airline pilots and even special FAA officials tasked with responding to all types of out-of-the-ordinary incidents that occur in the sky on a daily basis seem just as puzzled with this event as we are makes the story all that much more intriguing. That's intriguing, all right. And if anything, I mean, I'd say that this is probably also startling. Because it has to be said that in a post-9/11 world, if an object shows up and it's behaving like that, not following standards in accordance with FAA regulations, apparently acting evasively like that, I mean, fighter jets are scrambled and they don't find out what this thing is, that's more than just a bit concerning. Certainly not a conventional experience, even if it doesn't involve what we'd call a conventional UFO. More after this, it is the Graylian Report. Extremely appropriate song. That's right, Monkey Warhol sent along some great music for us to feature here on the program a while back. Do check out his music online, Monkey Warhol, as in Andy Warhol, the artist. One more quick quote, by the way, from Tyler Rogoway, who wrote on the story that we talked about in the last segment at The Drive. In his update, he had mentioned this. He said, above all else, this new evidence pertaining to that incident from last November, the new evidence underscores just how rare these events actually are, especially ones that include multiple sightings, the use of multiple sensors, the involvement of various agencies, including the military, and some of the most capable air-to-air fighters in the world. And after recent reports unmasking how the Pentagon remains highly interested in encounters just like this one, it holds even more weight than it did 3 months ago. We will continue to investigate this bizarre incident and keep you updated as to what else we uncover. But, yeah, just when I thought there wasn't going to be any mention of the official Pentagon UFO program, he brings it up. Now, there's no indication that that thing that was being followed in that incident was some sort of an anomalous-looking aircraft. They described it as being the size of a typical jet. It was moving quickly, but it certainly wasn't a small aircraft or an unmanned drone. But that's still really, really weird. I get extremely excited when I come across reports of things like this. And I tell you, having written about some similar incidents myself in the book, The Ghost Rockets, from a number of years ago, and digging through the records of the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which is maintained by NASA. I don't know, maybe I'm overdue to go back through. Every few years, I like to go back. Ever since I wrote that book, I'll go and I'll find new reports, because, of course, there are going to be new ones that are filed by pilots and their crews following incidents like this. For all we know, there may even be some existing data that's already publicly available that the ASRS has released in relation to that very same event. I don't know. That would be interesting. If you have any friends, or if you yourself are a pilot, by the way, and you've experienced something like that, I would love to hear from you. info@graylianreport.com or info@micahhanks.com, my email. You can email me like that. You can follow me on Twitter @micahhanks, and you can send me messages there. But the email is typically the best way to communicate for reports like that. Yeah, I would love to hear if you or a family member or a friend has had similar experiences, or you've got a story you'd like to share. Stories of any kind, not just related to unidentified objects and things like that. I mean, we like to hear about those things on this program, so do email me, info@micahhanks.com. I would love to hear from you. And in fact, that very means of communication is how I came into communication initially with my most remarkable research assistant, Miss Lauren Ellis. And she sent along something for consideration on today's program. The idea that genes in the bodies of humans and presumably other organisms continue to operate even after death. This isn't something that we've talked about very recently, if at all, on this program. The discovery that many genes are still working up to 48 hours after death. Now, what are the implications of this? Well, I mean, obviously, it may have to do with organ transplants, even forensics and investigations of homicides and things like that. But it also may even change certain aspects of our definition of what it means to die. What is death? For instance, when a doctor declares a person dead, some of their body may still be alive and kicking for at least a day or two. That's right, this hustle and bustle has been seen in mice and zebrafish, but there are even hints that genes are also active for some time in deceased humans. So what exactly does that mean in terms of death? Well, I mean, I guess you could say that death occurs, consciousness is lost, an organism is no longer acting in accordance with its own will, but I mean, there may be processes within the dying or dead body even that more slowly degenerate over the following days, but there is still a level of activity that registers. That's essentially probably what it has to do with. Lauren wrote to me about it and said, it's all so interesting. I wonder if this may be why some Buddhist philosophies even suggest to wait 3 days after dying before doing a cremation or burial. And it is interesting because there are a lot of traditions of this sort of thing. According to the last rites of the Amitabha, she writes, the body of the deceased should not be touched, disturbed, or moved in any way because they believe the soul doesn't leave the body immediately after breathing stops. She says, I think this subject could lead into a good discussion on Graylian about consciousness after we die. Now, I remember when I was in history class back in college, I had a professor. And he talked about, in the Middle Ages, one of the weird experiments involving this very subject, where a man who was sentenced to death and was beheaded, he said, I will blink my eyes if I can after I, again, this is his beheaded head, okay, his disembodied head. He said, I will blink my eyes if I can once my head leaves my body. So they had this novel opportunity for this experiment. So the guy goes up there and he's sentenced to death and they behead him and his head falls into the basket. And the observers who were his associates who were tasked with observing said that he blinked something like 14 or 15 times. The disembodied head. I'll have to find that story. That's just, again, me recollecting this from my days in college. But it's quite fascinating stuff. Now, here's another excerpt from an article that she sends along. Research has shown that people who survive medical death frequently report experiences that share similar themes that include bright lights, benevolent guiding figures, relief from physical pain, and a deeply felt sensation of peace. Because those experiences are subjective, it's possible to chalk them up to hallucinations. Where that explanation fails, though, is among the patients who have died on an operating table or crash cart and reported watching from a corner of the room or from above as doctors tried to save them, accounts subsequently verified by the very perplexed doctors themselves. We had Dr. Scott Kolboba on this program a few months ago, and he talked about these kinds of what many call miraculous experiences in the operating room. To me, I don't think it's all that unusual, at very least in the context of a broad narrative that has been going on for centuries that involves people describing near-death experiences. The only thing that's unusual about it is science trying to account for it, and when they can't, saying that it's probably a purely hallucinatory, and it could be. It could be some mental construct. Hallucinations that are induced as a result of lack of oxygen getting to the brain, any number of things like that. But at the end of the day, what it always seems to come back to is, I mean, how much do we really know about what we know? And I'm not just talking epistemologically here. I mean, there is so much about the everyday experience of living that we haven't quite put a finger on. Sometimes of all the mysteries of the world, just being human is the most mysterious. More when we return. It is the Graylian Report.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting from the high mountains of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Glad to be in pocket with you, as always, and about to turn our attention to those things which occur below. And by that I mean, again, this is something, a concept really, that has always fascinated me. Not only the actual biological or speleological discoveries, for that matter, that await below our feet, but also the myth and the culture, the tradition, the folklore, the superstition even, that is kind of built around that idea of the underworld. Whether it be Dante's Inferno, or modern depictions in horror films. I mean, this is just something that has long fascinated me. Before we get into that discussion, and also a few notes from folks at home like you, I do want to remind you, as always, if you like this podcast and you'd like to support what we do, one way you can do that is you can head on over to GraylianReport.com and subscribe to Graylian X. What's unique about our subscription service is that it's additional content. We don't pay, or rather, we don't make you pay for an interview, for instance. We don't feature half of a show on this podcast, and then you have to go sign up to be able to hear the complete, unedited audio. No, what we actually do is we provide additional content through Graylian X subscriptions, and once you subscribe, you're essentially pledging support to the program in a way that shows that the content we produce is of merit and meaning to you, that you enjoy it, and that you appreciate it. And of course, in doing so and pledging that support through a subscription, we give you additional content, monthly specials like Graylian Enigmas, the weekly additional edition Graylian X podcast, and of course, access to all the back catalog of the program. Because once you subscribe, you get your own individual RSS feed that gives you both this weekly program, the Graylian Report, and the additional content that comes out all on a single feed. It all comes directly to your app or your device, or you can log in and listen on your computer. I mean, however you prefer to do that. But that's what we do and how we do it. And I really prefer that to the whole, let's give you half of it and tease you, and then you got to pay to be able to hear the whole show. That model works well for a lot of people who do it. We prefer not to. We like to kind of keep these programs and podcasts standalone, because I know that everybody who listens, they can't all subscribe. And I want people to be able to get their bang for their buck, even if there aren't any dollars going into it. So consider subscribing, support what we do, and we appreciate that as always. Now, getting to a few views from folks like you in the listener emails. First up this week, we've got an email from Chandler who writes, good evening to the good doctor and everyone that might hear this. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not a real doctor. I just play one on the radio. I've been listening to your show ever since you made your appearance on Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Sprague. Good friend. Great podcast, by the way. Do check it out. He said, I find it entertaining, thought-provoking, and often find myself lost in thought with some of the guests and topics that have come on your program. And the reason I'm writing you this email is to tell you about something that happened last night. After a long weekend away from home, I fell asleep last night watching some fun YouTube videos and just getting a good laugh before bed. I ended up falling asleep around 10 p.m. and had a very vivid and lucid dream. I was able to control a lot of my actions and quickly realized that I was in a dream. I was having conversations with friends, walking around a house very similar to one of my friends, and was interacting with objects as if they were real. To be honest, the only way that I knew I was in a dream was that it was black and white. That's kind of interesting. Anyway, I decided in my dream to go and lay down. My dream state was telling me that if I wanted to fall asleep in real life, that I had to fall asleep in the dream. It made logical sense, and so I went into a bedroom and laid down. Now, right before I laid down, I noticed that everything had real color to it. It was no longer black and white. It was just full of color, and it was as if the room was real. It looked like my current bedroom. I didn't think anything about it and proceeded to lay down and go to sleep. And just as I was beginning to fall asleep, I felt something pull around my throat and yank backward. I instantly woke up in my dream, choking. I grabbed toward my throat and realized that there was something around it. I could feel the pressure, but I couldn't grab the object. It felt like a rubber rope was pulling around my throat and closing my trachea. I looked over my shoulder and saw nothing, but felt something was there. I closed my eyes, pulled my hands toward where the pressure was, and I started to recite the Lord's Prayer while thinking of St. Michael. I was just into the prayer, maybe about a full sentence in, when I felt the pressure lift and I awoke with a sharp inhale. I looked around my bedroom for anything. I didn't see anything in the shadows, but I felt cold. I went through my dresser drawer until I found the cross I was given by my grandmother that has the Lord's Prayer in it and two medals, one that was blessed to help me with bad dreams and one that has the Saints Christopher and Michael on each side. I'll pass this along. I have been into the paranormal for a long time. I've been reading and researching paranormal stuff since I was 9, and I got a book about mysterious disappearances at sea like the USS Cyclops, Flight 19, and the Mary Celeste, to name a few. I know what some will say about it being a dream. My body had actually stopped breathing, and this was its way of waking up. But the pressure, the feeling of terror, and the helplessness along with how I woke up leads me to believe that it was something else. I honestly don't know what to make of it because I didn't see a shadow person. I didn't feel anything on my chest like what's been described in the incubus or succubus or old hag stories. And I haven't had any paranormal instances in this house. I don't know what it was, but it definitely felt as if something was trying to strangle me in my sleep. Any advice or insight into this would greatly help. Sincerely, Chandler. Well, Chandler, I can certainly say that, I mean, many people do describe, as it relates to, you mentioned the old hag there, and in relation to the phenomenon known as sleep paralysis, this does sound very similar to some of the instances that that experience involves, namely the feeling of either being unable to breathe. As you mentioned, some people describe a kind of pressure being pushed down on their chest or something. Now, you describe it as though that there was a rope around your neck choking you. Nonetheless, it is very similar. What's more interesting to me about sleep paralysis isn't so much the fact that, well, we can explain it. It's the fact that there's such a consistency to the way that we perceive that experience across cultures of being someone like an old hag or a witch or something like that, an incubus, a succubus, actually sitting on top of you and holding you down, and it becomes difficult to breathe. I wonder about the consistency in the human mind. If there isn't something more to that, and across cultures, why the experience in the dream state, as our minds are undergoing the experience while unconscious, I wonder sometimes what it is that causes that commonality across cultures. I saw the evolutionary biologist P.Z. Myers on Twitter recently referring to archetypes as being merely stereotypes. Apparently, he's not a fan of Carl Jung. But nonetheless, and however you may choose to interpret it, there are very much, call them stereotypes if you want to, but again, the stereotypical images that are prevalent in mythologies from around the world and in cultures, and some of them in relation to human experiences like sleep paralysis, that in itself is pretty fascinating to me. Dominique writes, Morn, my good man, I just wanted to drop a line and ask you to reconsider your exceptionally quick dismissal of the series as mentioned on the previous show. That would be Altered Carbon, by the way. He said, which I enjoyed greatly, just to add. The series Richard K. Morgan wrote in 2002, recipient of the Philip K. Dick Award in 2003 for Best Novel, in my not-so-humble opinion, top-notch sci-fi fear. The core concepts of the first novel in the world he created digitally, or digital immortality, transference of consciousness, and the social ramifications were ahead of their time. The novels read at a breakneck pace that the show keeps up with easily, making this hard-boiled neon noir vision of the future easily one of my top three favorite sci-fi series of all time. So please do give it a solid look as I believe you will truly enjoy it, if only to muse on the parallels currently in the zeitgeist today of simulated reality and the potential of the digital front. Best wishes, Dominique. And actually, Dominique, I saw your email yesterday prior to reading it on today's program and decided to put the show back on last night. I did make it through another episode, and as time allows, perhaps I'll try and watch a few more. Although, admittedly, even some of my favorite shows, or what would later become some of my favorite shows, I should say, they didn't begin necessarily as being favorites. Now, that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes you'll sit down and you watch something and you'll know this is an instant classic. I love every minute of it as I'm watching it. Yeah, sometimes it takes a little time to get into something. I think that Altered Carbon is probably more like that. It's one of these programs that maybe it doesn't immediately hook you, but I won't dispute the fact that, yeah, it is indeed a breakneck pace. It's very well constructed. Definitely deals with a lot of themes that I think we singularitarian types would be interested in. The idea of, again, as Dominique talks about, the transference of consciousness into a digital state or into an avatar, another body. Skins, I think, is what they call them on the show. I will also advise parents out there in the audience, though, there's a lot of nudity in the show. And so if you've got kids watching with you, the violence and other adult themes you might want to be aware of before you sit down with your, you know, grade school kids and start watching the show. Yeah. Todd writes, Micah, I was listening to this week's episode on my way to work and heard you and Matt talking about flat earther rocket envy. It occurred to me that this must be doubly embarrassing to the flat earthers. If the earth is flat, then they should only need to generate enough thrust to get their rocket over the edge. No need to worry about escape velocity. Great point. I love it. In fact, if they set up in the right place, they shouldn't even need a rocket. I would suggest that they focus on simpler technology. A large trabucket set up near the edge should do the job. A 12th century solution for a 16th century problem. Keep up the work, Todd. That might be the email of the week right there. That's some good stuff right there indeed. Oh, goodness. One more. Let's see here. Dan writes, Mike, I only recently heard about the Georgia Guidestones. Have you ever covered them on the Graylian Report? They're not far from the bunker. I think they're kind of fascinating. You know, in truth, Dan, we have covered the Georgia Guidestones on the program in the past. My good friend, Dr. Mike Bennett, came on the program. And if you go back in the archives far enough, you should be able to find those, or rather find that episode. But our take on that, again, is that, and I think what Dr. Bennett found out was that in likelihood, there was a doctor from around Salt Lake City. He had had involvement in some rather interesting ideological areas, we'll say. He'd been a supporter, for instance, of David Duke when the guy was running for president. You may remember David Duke marching around on college campuses dressed as a Nazi back in the day. Yeah. But there is definitely a connection to this idea of population control, New World Order kind of stuff, as evidenced by what actually is said, at very least in the English language script, on the Georgia Guidestones. There are a lot of different languages represented, and a lot of people see it as very weird, New World Orderly kind of stuff. Yeah, and maybe indeed there was a little of that. So again, if you've never been to the Georgia Guidestones and you happen to be near Elberton, Georgia, they are right there off the side of the highway. You can drive right up and see them, and they are open to the public, I believe, like 365 days of the year. I think that the little parking area may close. I'm not sure if it does, though. I know it was right around sundown when my friend Susan and I went and saw them. And if you're anywhere nearby, it's worth going and seeing. Although I hear that there is an identical monument, I believe, in Salt Lake City. So if anybody in Salt Lake City, I know we've got some friends out there and part of the KGRA staff based out in Utah, in that general area. I mean, if anybody listening has been to or knows about a Guidestone-esque monument there in Salt Lake City, I'd like to hear from you about that. Or maybe you could even send along some pictures, info@micahanks.com. Would love to hear from you. Okay, so getting into the discussion that will comprise the remainder of the hour. We've got some interesting things happening in the news as it relates to discoveries made underground. You may have heard over the last few weeks about this very widespread, I mean, just like a huge Mayan complex that was found in the middle of the jungle. And again, part of what makes these sites accessible to us today is satellite technology. We're able to image them from above remotely, as opposed to having to go there on foot, which in the past made these sites largely inaccessible. But you do think about things like Percy Fawcett and his pursuit of the lost city of Z. It could be that in the coming years, some of the new archaeological discoveries that we're making in these deep, very inaccessible areas of the jungles of South America, they may ultimately prove to be the lost city that Fawcett and others have long sought. And I'm sure that there'll be more information forthcoming too. But as far as news, not only of that which exists above ground and is difficult to access, but things that may also be a little lower below sea level. Reuters reports this week on a discovery archaeologists made while exploring the world's biggest flooded cave in Mexico. And it involves the discovery of ancient human remains. These are at least 9,000 years old, but also the bones of animals who roamed the earth during the last ice age. According to the report, a group of divers recently connected two underwater caverns in eastern Mexico to reveal what is believed to be the biggest flooded cave on the planet, a discovery that could help shed new light on the ancient Mayan civilization. The Yucatan Peninsula is studded with monumental relics of the Maya people, whose cities drew upon an extensive network of sinkholes linked to the subterranean waters known as cenotes. Researchers say that they found 248 of these cenotes at the 347-kilometer cave system known as Sacactún, near the beach resort of Tulum. I've actually been to Tulum. It's crazy. So right beneath our feet, there was a lot of this going on. Of the 200 archaeological sites that they have discovered there, around 140, they say, are Mayan. Now, some cenotes acquired particular religious significance to the Maya, whose descendants continue to inhabit the region. Apart from human remains, they also found bones of giant sloths, ancient elephants, and extinct bears from the Pleistocene period, Mexico's culture ministry said in a statement. The cave's discovery has rocked the archaeological world. I think it's overwhelming, and this quote from Guillermo de Anda, a researcher at Mexico's National Anthropology and Historical Institute. Without a doubt, he says, it's the most important underwater archaeological site in the world. And we talk about these kinds of discoveries. And, you know, there are plenty of sites up here on the North American continent, too, that not only would probably yield similar discoveries and yet remain unexplored, but some which have been explored and which have not only captured the mind in terms of what history they show, but also just the general presence of entering a cave. I don't know how many of you guys out there have actually had the benefit of being able to go into a subterranean passageway or cavern. I've spent a lot of time over the years in caves. In fact, if anything, I've kind of been drawn to them. And in part, what led to that was, of all things, you know, I watched that film, The Descent, when I was in my early 20s. And again, it's not the kind of film that necessarily makes caves seem any more inviting. But for me, it was just the opposite. I mean, I watched that film, which at the time I remember scaring the daylights out of me, but I enjoyed it. And I ended up going out and buying Jeff Long's novel, which I've mentioned many times over the years on this program. And The Descent, the novel, is apparently unrelated to that film. And I, in truth, enjoyed the novel a lot more than the film. The film was okay, really, in comparison to the novel, which was, as I've often said in the past, it was a blend of, like, what that film involves mixed with Hollow Earth legends and a bit of Da Vinci Code. That's a good way to describe it. It's just a great novel. But a lot of authors have been inspired by stories about caves, like presumably Jeff Long had been as an actual mountain climber and guide in the Himalayas over the years, and a lot of his experiences trekking through the mountains and no doubt probably finding caves and things as well kind of inspired what he wrote about in that fiction novel. Now, a lot of authors have been inspired by things that they have found in caves, and we'll return to one of the most famous instances of that here in a moment. First, I want to talk about a site that I've never been to in terms of caves I've gone in, but one I definitely want to visit at some point. Every time I drive up to Louisville, Kentucky to visit Tiffany Mack, I see the signs for Mammoth Cave. And not only is there a lot of history associated with Mammoth Cave, but there are also some interesting stories associated with it too. In fact, cultofweird.com recounts a few of those. They refer to it, of course, Mammoth Cave, as no doubt the world's greatest subterranean wonder, at least next to that which was recently discovered in Mexico. But it's located in an area that's roughly only a few miles in diameter, and the cave twists and turns and stretches to a length of some 400 miles and depths of 30 stories, and that's only the explored tunnels. No doubt, like many cave systems, it goes even deeper, and there are unexplored regions that go down further, which also probably boast biological organisms which we have not yet found, and which have not yet been accounted for by science. But in addition to the biological treasures that a location like Mammoth Cave may afford us with the unexplored regions deep within it, you got to keep in mind that there's a lot of history associated with it too. At least there was 4,000 years ago, human habitation at Mammoth Cave. And along with these archaeological discoveries that have been made there that show this long-spanning human history, and of course also megafaunal species and different kinds of creatures that have been found in the area around it and within the cave, we also have a more recent history that incorporates hauntings at this site. As Cult of Weird .com reports, in the late 1700s, a member of the Houchin family found the cave while bear hunting. During the War of 1812, the cave was used as a saltpeter mine to aid in the production of gunpowder, After the war ended, the cave became one of the nation's first tourist attractions once the mummies within it were discovered. This was a period of history when the mummies were believed to be members of a lost race of people rather than Native American ancestors, which added to the mystery of the place. Affluent citizens from all over the country would come in and tour the caves. And in fact, one of the people who visited the cave in the early part of the last century was none other than the horror author H.P. Lovecraft. And one of his earliest stories not only was inspired by his visit, but also takes place in Mammoth Cave. And as we're exploring the myth and the history associated with locations like this, but also the symbolism of the cave and the idea of entering, going below ground in search of treasure, perhaps a new undiscovered species, or any number of other things, perhaps even the remnants of ancient people and their way of life who came long before us. And there's something that truly, I think, is captivating about entering the cave environment. And even if you've never been in one, and you've never frequented subterranean caverns like I do when time allows, allow your mind to wander and feel as though you yourself were entering an unexplored cavernous region deep below ground, dark, dank, and nothing to accompany you but the echoes, perhaps the sense of the moist cave environment, and whatever else might reside there. Imagine this as so many before us have done the same thing, entering caves in ancient times, without any knowledge of what might reside there. This is no doubt how H.P. Lovecraft felt when he first entered Mammoth Cave, and of course had the experience there which became the basis for his short story. The horrible conclusion, which had been gradually obtruding itself upon my confused and reluctant mind, was now an awful certainty. I was lost completely, hopelessly lost in the vast and labyrinthine recesses of the Mammoth Cave. Turn as I might, in no direction could my straining vision seize on any object capable of serving as a guidepost to set me on the outward path. That nevermore should I behold the blessed light of day or scan the pleasant hills and dales of the beautiful world outside, my reason could no longer entertain the slightest unbelief. Hope had departed, yet indoctrinated as I was by a life of philosophical study, I derived no small measure of satisfaction from my unimpassioned demeanor. For although I had frequently read of the wild frenzies into which were thrown the victims of similar situations, I experienced none of these, but stood quiet as soon as I clearly realized the loss of my bearings. Nor did the thought that I had probably wandered beyond the utmost limits of an ordinary search cause me to abandon my composure even for a moment. If I must die, I reflected, then was this terrible yet majestic cavern as welcome a sepulture as that which any churchyard might afford, a conception which carried with it more of tranquility than of despair. Starving would prove my ultimate fate. Of this I was certain. Some, I knew, had gone mad under circumstances such as these, but I felt that this end would not be mine. My disaster was the result of no fault save my own, since unbeknown to the guide I had separated myself from the regular party of sightseers, and, wandering for over an hour in forbidden avenues of the cave, had found myself unable to retrace the devious windings which I had pursued since forsaking my companions. This, of course, the beginning of Lovecraft's famous early story of what one man found while lost in the depths of Mammoth Cave, and of course serving as the basis, in fact, for a fictional yarn, the likes of which Lovecraft was best known, and one which nonetheless plays off of the long-held fears that humankind has held for the world that exists below us. So as we proceed deeper into the cavernous realm of the mind, if not the earth, we'll look at some of the mystery and fascination that caves have held and the discoveries that have been found in such locations, as well as the legends that have been built around them, when we return here on the Graylian Report.
We'll be right back.
From the dark, cavernous realm deep below the Appalachian Mountains, I'm Micah Hanks, and we're broadcasting from the cavernous realm within the mind tonight as we explore the mysteries that may indeed exist below us. Indeed, caves and the mythology that's been built around them, and of course the scientific discoveries that have been made and no doubt will continue to be made in them, have long fascinated me. In fact, I wrote an article about this a few years back. I'll kind of preface this by saying that a lot of people will tell you that we know more about the moon, okay, than we know about our own oceans and the depths of them and what animals may exist there. In fact, marine biologists speculate that an incredible number of species, as yet undiscovered, may still exist within parts of the deep ocean, especially areas like the Mariana Trench and others that are less easily accessible. But you got to keep in mind that, again, the deep oceans aren't the only places on or within the Earth where new forms of life may be found. I remember digging through the book that the Sierra Club put out years ago. It was actually titled Caving, the Sierra Club Guide to Spelunking. I picked up a copy of it, I think, at a used bookstore. And Lane and Peggy Larson, the authors, make the case for why more and more people tend to be drawn to the underground. This isn't just something that we look at in terms of the mythic history of humankind or something that biologists are drawn toward. More people seem to be drawn toward caves, also including the weekend adventurer types. Technological improvements have broadened our ability to descend safely into caves. And of course, these technologies have kind of renewed our interest in something that I think at one time people were fascinated with because they were looking for clues to the ancient past. And of course, as the recent discoveries in the underwater cave system in Mexico have shown, we still find them there. But I have a quote here that the Larsons wrote in that book, and it reads as follows. In the last 30 years, the art of cave exploration has been revolutionized by radical improvements in caving equipment and the adoption of new techniques, many of these adapted from mountaineering. These improvements have spawned a vital explosion of cave exploration and scientific investigation. Suddenly, man has dropped deeper and crawled farther underground in natural caverns and done so in greater safety than he's ever done before or had the privilege to accomplish. And there are greater depths, longer passages, and scientific questions begging answers. And just to illustrate this, the Washington Post featured an article back in 2004 where they spoke with a number of experts in modern caving and the science applied to it. They cite that there are 8,600 known caves, with Tennessee having more than any other state, which, according to the article, provides, quote, a home for countless ancient and rare creatures that dwell underground and out of sight. Skipping ahead, they note that Tennessee's caverns are part of the nation's most elaborate cave network, which extends under Alabama, Georgia, and Kentucky, and beyond to Indiana, Virginia, and West Virginia. Most of these caves have never been surveyed for their biodiversity, and some scientific experts estimate, get this, that as many as 1,000 species are yet to be discovered within these unexplored cave regions. Sheltered until recently from the outside world and with few opportunities to escape, a variety of largely unknown species of cave flora and fauna have evolved out of sight over millions of years. And the article goes on to say that many are rarer than ones on the federal government's endangered species list. Biologists use a global rank of rarity scale that specifies whether a species exists in 1 to 5 sites in the world, 6 to 20 sites, 21 to 100 sites, and so on. And the study shows that after exploring 22 caves near the Tennessee-Kentucky border in 2003 alone, one of the experts who was featured in this article discovered 43 species within those caves of global significance, including the cave flatworm, the two-clawed spider, and 4 previously unknown species of millipedes. So as you can see, I mean, most of these animal species found in these caves are much smaller. They're not the large variety. But the fact remains that there are probably untold numbers of similar species that still exist underground and that have yet to be discovered or accounted for, and some of them which may be at very least, according to these same sorts of classifications, close to being critically endangered. The point is, we don't know what's down there. And there could be a lot more than we imagine. But speaking of the imagination again, no doubt it was in this same spirit of discovery that people like H.P. Lovecraft, when he would travel down into Mammoth Cave, his imagination began to wander. And in the darkness and in the depths of these caves, which go on farther than probably anyone has ever explored, to what depths would one have to go in order to find new species? And if they did go that far below ground, what exactly might they hope to find? I'm sure this was on Lovecraft's mind as he explored those regions of Mammoth Cave, and of course as the narrator of his story would tell us, stumbled onto something that he perhaps would have been far better off had he never found. Already my torch had begun to expire. Soon I would be enveloped by the total and almost palpable blackness of the bowels of the earth. As I stood in the waning, unsteady light, I idly wondered over the exact circumstances of my coming end. I remembered the accounts which I had heard of the colony of consumptives, who, taking their residence in this gigantic grotto to find health from the apparently salubrious air of the underground world, with its steady uniform temperature, pure air, and peaceful quiet, had found instead death in strange and ghastly form. I had seen the sad remains of their ill-made cottages as I passed them by with the party, and had wondered what unnatural influence a long sojourn in this immense and silent cavern would exert upon one as healthy and as vigorous as I. Now, I grimly told myself, my opportunity for settling this point had arrived, provided that want of food should not bring me too speedy a departure from this life. As the last fitful rays of my torch faded into obscurity, I resolved to leave no stone unturned, no possible means of escape neglected. So, summoning all the powers possessed by my lungs, I set up a series of loud shoutings in the vain hope of attracting the attention of the guide by my clamor. Yet as I called, I believed in my heart that my cries were to no purpose, and that my voice, magnified and reflected by the numberless ramparts of the black maze around me, fell upon no ears save my own. All at once, however, my attention was fixed with a start as I fancied that I heard the sound of soft approaching steps on the rocky floor of the cavern. Was my deliverance about to be accomplished so soon? Had, then, all my horrible apprehensions been for naught? And was the guide, having marked my unwarranted absence from the party, following my course and seeking me out in the limestone labyrinth? Whilst these joyful queries arose in my brain, I was on the point of renewing my cries in order that my discovery might come the sooner, when in an instant my delight was turned to horror as I listened. For my ever-acute ear, now sharpened in ever greater degree by the complete silence of the cave, bore to my benumbed understanding the expected and dreadful knowledge that these footfalls were not like those of any mortal man. In the unearthly stillness of the subterranean region, the tread of the booted guide would have sounded like a series of sharp and incisive blows. These impacts were soft and stealthy, as of the padded paws of some feline. Besides, at times, when I listened carefully, it seemed to trace the falls of 4 instead of 2 feet. We must remind ourselves, I think, at times when reviewing the literature, the likes of H.P. Lovecraft and his masterful storytelling abilities, that, of course, these things exist in the realm of the imagination. Although, from time to time, in cryptozoological circles, there are some unusual stories that come to light. There was one that I looked into a few years ago, in fact, which had appeared on the website of the Crypto Crew, a Tennessee-based cryptozoological research group. And much the likes of something from a Lovecraft story, very similar, in fact, to what we've heard, there was a story from Hamblen County, Tennessee, near the town of Morristown, that was submitted to the group a few years ago, which caught my eye and actually led me to contact them with further information if they would provide it. I'll read first from the report, and this offered by a woman who said that she had a cave on her property that she and her husband would often visit because there had been interesting things on the walls and evidence of perhaps early human occupation in the caves. Her report reads as follows: I stood less than 2 feet face to face with a cryptic, I presume she means a cryptid, hybrid, 4 feet in length, no hair on the face, white skin, and human-like features. The body was covered in brown hair, short legs, heavy paws with claws that are flat on the end. And most interestingly, she said it could climb the cave walls and freeze in one place. I've been on a quest ever since looking for the truth and have uncovered evidence of this species that could be a cousin to the Bigfoot, but maybe smaller. They're still there. I know this because the cavern is on my farm that I encountered. I've tried to reach out to professionals, but no one will investigate it. I don't understand when something is discovered like this that there may not be any more receptive than that. Evolution took many different routes, obviously. She goes on to say that we just rediscovered the cave 6 years ago, and it has many unexplored chambers still. University of Tennessee said it was like Swiss cheese. I drew pictures that day and told all that I could. Several years later, while researching, I came across proof of this hybrid creature in a rare 16th century document from a good source Vespucci, with the exact plate showing this animal with a human's face but a bear-like body. The only problem I have is getting someone to read the old dramatic description. The male species I encountered had brown eyes and features just like a human, but the rest was more like an animal, a lot like a fisher's body with a human and a white man's face. That confused me the most. I know that they're still there, she says, concluding her report. Nothing happened during the encounter. We both froze in shock, and it took in each other's detail before I finally ran. She said it had no smell. It was pretty clean looking, including the nails on the feet. I would say a young male by his features. He was as scared as I was, but I would still hate to be swiped by the strong looking paws. I would take a lie detector test. I have nothing to gain by this except answers. It really makes me mad that no one seems to care. Now, needless to say, that's a rather unusual report, and the idea of a creature that can crawl along the side of cave walls and freeze in places she describes sounds an awful lot more like the kinds of things that we see in films. But nonetheless, I do wonder sometimes about stories like this, and I contacted the people there in Tennessee, and they actually sent along photographs and said, yeah, the cave exists, we've been out there to the property, but right now that farm is actually for sale, and thus the members of the crypto crew weren't able to get access to the area. You know, I'm also reminded of a story. And this one made the rounds years ago. I don't know how many of you guys out there remember GeoCities and Angel Fire, but a number of years ago, and this stepping out of the realm that borders fact and fiction and firmly into folklore, but there was this story that appeared on a number of the sites over the years. I think it's still archived on the Creepypasta website of Slenderman fame even to this day, and it involves the story of Ted the Caver. Okay? And the story originally appeared as a series of blog posts, if you could call it a blog. This was almost really kind of in the era before these things were called blogs, but a spelunker who identified himself as Ted told of a number of weird experiences that he had had exploring a mystery cave. Now, the first page went up on March 23rd, 2001, and Ted had kind of created these posts like an ongoing journal of his experiences. And interestingly, he actually featured a lot of photographs that showed him and his friend, who he identifies only as B, there inside the cave. And so being close enough to Ted's house, he and B began to explore it, and they're putting up the posts along with the pictures of the things that they're finding, and they at some point find a fairly small little kind of a cavity that they're able to see through, and it shows that there's a passageway. They have to widen this to be able to fit through it, and as any sane person would want to do, they're inching their way through this very small passageway that's barely big enough to be able to fit their body, so that they can explore deeper into this cave. Well, it starts innocuous enough that these guys are exploring this cave that goes underneath a part of the highway, but as the story goes on, they begin to encounter weird things inside the cave. And Ted starts talking about what sound like ghastly screams that come from down inside the cave. There's this unnatural sort of a wind that's reported. There are even weird hieroglyphics that they start finding on the walls inside the cave. Some of you guys may have seen the film The Ritual on Netflix recently, and the runes and things that appear on trees. Imagine you're deep inside a cave, you're hearing unnatural sounds and wind blowing, and you start finding weird hieroglyphics, just the kind of thing you want to find when you're down in that cave. And then on May 19th, 2001, after several posts, the blog just ends abruptly. After detailing about 3 weeks since their last visit to the cave. And during this time, each of the cavers reported suffering from various different ailments that included hallucinations, nightmares, headaches. And finally, Ted, B, and their other friend Joe agree to visit the cave one final time for closure. And so they suit up, they're prepared to enter the cave. They've got a gun and a knife this time because that's going to help them fight whatever monstrous forces may exist deep below. And in the final blog, Ted states that he will update the website immediately after he returns with answers to everyone's questions, and then the site, of course, isn't updated thereafter. So long before there was Slender Man, there was Ted and his mystery cave, but the weird part about the story is the fact that, indeed, one of these, the Interstate Cave, as it's known as, the actual cave, is known to exist. It's actually located in Utah, and parts of the story appeared on the National Speleological Society's message board. They said that based on the photographs that Ted had put up, it looked very much like, indeed, they had been in Interstate Cave, a known cave that had even been charted. In fact, Ralph Powers, there was a post that was made on the National Speleological Society's message board in November of 2004 that talked about all this. And Ralph Powers talks about the fact that the caves went under the interstate, but and he had even gone so far as to suspect that the this weird noises, like the screams and things that Ted and the guys talked about hearing, were actually the sounds of tractor trailers, screeching tires, 18-wheelers passing overhead, and that that sound filtered through the earth had caused distortions in the sound and caused them to sound like all kinds of weird stuff other than what they actually were. Now, people wondered about this story for years. Is it true? Was Ted a real person? And did what he and B and Joe claimed happened down there in that cave actually occur? In 2004, a story appears online titled The Fear of Darkness, written by a guy calling himself Thomas Lara. And the story's timeline occurred, they said, between 1987 and 2004. And among others, this got the attention of some of the members there of the National Speleological Society message board. In fact, they believed it to be the original story and associated with that of Ted the Caver. And finally, the following year on January 5th, a fellow calling himself Ted started a thread on the board, and he revealed all. He said that Ted the Caver's page was his own original work. He simply elaborated on a real experience with supernatural elements and even talked about the fact that the story had been a sort of creative writing exercise. And again, you can still find it linked even to this day on Creepypasta. I sent it to Lauren the other night and didn't tell her anything about the actual history of it and its subsequent debunking as Ted came forward and finally admitted what it had been. I thought it was brilliant, in fact, and quite frankly, a lot of fun. But then again, as Slenderman shows, some of these stories intended to be amusing and entertaining from the outset end up going on to do sometimes more damaging things, although fortunately with Ted the Caver, nobody found their way down into Interstate Cave looking for ancient hieroglyphics or screaming demons or anything like that. If anything, the idea of these monstrosities that exist deep within the earth is purely the fiction which I think accompanies the idea of deep, dark, unexplored, cavernous regions in general. And that, in truth, is part of what I think has always attracted people to caves. And really speaking more personally about it, a lot of that, in fact, had also played into the mythos that surrounds this very podcast. Ever since the very outset of the Graylian Report, we've worked very hard to kind of incorporate this mythology of a hollow earth, and that built onto the existing mythology of stories that go all the way back to the 1940s and 50s, like the Shaver Mystery, Richard Sharp Shaver writing into Amazing Stories magazine and talking about the Darrows and the Taros, two warring factions of an ancient lost civilization that exist deep below ground. And of course, unbeknownst to most of us here existing on the world above, it's a long-held fascination that these kind of stories play into. And yes, some of it goes back to much earlier times, Dante's Inferno, Edda Dorfa, the various writings from over the years, centuries in fact, that recount our fascination with that which may exist below. And again, as science shows us, we know an awful lot about the moon. We continue to study the deep oceans, but it very well may be that there are things elsewhere in unexplored regions, and perhaps those deeper below that may bear fruit, and that of scientific discovery in the years to come. Rather than looking up always and outward, maybe we should look within, whether that be deep below ground or within the recesses of our own minds. That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. As always, on behalf of all of us here at Graylian Studios, I want to thank you guys for tuning in and being a part of this podcast. And on behalf of those of us associated with the program, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson, Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrell, Tiffany Mack, and the lovely assistant Lauren. We hope Matt Oakley gets to feeling a bit better, and he'll be back joining me here in studio again next week. I remain your humble doctor here in the dark heart of the hollow earth. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report, and until next time, we bid you adieu and stay strange out there.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.